Well, it gives me great, great pleasure to have a veritable legend as a guest this morning, Mr. Michael Gelin.
Arnie, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, people know about Michael Gelin, of course. He is a well-known planner. He's a real estate consultant. He's a property developer. There's really anything in the real estate field that he hasn't done, or at least has an opinion on. And I'm really looking forward to get to that opinion. But first, Michael, I look at your name. It's Michael Gelin. FCIP, RPP, MLAI, AIBC, retired architect. I mean, what, did you have to pay for these names or did you actually earn them?
I was made a fellow of the Canadian Institute of Planners in 2008. I remember it because I was in the middle of an election campaign. I went to Winnipeg. So I am a registered professional planner, and I'm also a member of an organization called Lambda Alpha International, an honorary urban land economics group that you're familiar with. I don't think you should be a member, but anyway, it's a group of older people like me who've been around, but from various, aspects of the profession. And I was a registered architect for 40 plus years. Now I'm a retired architect because I don't do drawings other than for my own projects or my clients' projects. So that way I save on paying the dues, but more importantly, filling out the continuing education credits forms, which were a real pain.
Well, I know that you studied architecture at the University of Toronto. Whenever I say Toronto, you know, Vancouverites get a little shiver. So you're forgiven. But when did you get to Vancouver and saw the light?
1983, I was with CMHC. And sorry, 1973, I was with CMHC. And I was sent out to Vancouver because at the time I was working on a book on how to design homes for people in wheelchairs and with other disabilities. A local builder had been in a car accident, wanted to build a house for himself. I came out, it was the middle of February. Ottawa, where I was living at the time, was white, and Vancouver was all green. I'd never been here before. I thought, why wouldn't everybody want to live here? And a year later, I managed to arrange to be sent out here with CMHC initially to oversee the beginning of the redevelopment of Granville Island and the South Shore of False Creek, and to work on the social housing projects as the branch assistant architect planner. And I've been here almost ever since, although I did go back to Toronto and Ottawa from 1977 to 1981. I then came back and joined NAROD Developments, a name you'll remember, in 1981. As interest rates were hitting 18%. Young people listening to this need to know that interest rates were at 18%.
Yeah, I know, you know, everybody's complaining about how tough it was just to buy real estate today. Well, it was tough then, and some of the giants in the industry went bankrupt. I sort of somewhat foresaw that, although I thought of a much darker world ahead. And I took my family and we moved to Mexico for a year when I came back in 1982. The point is, we shouldn't be given dates, you know, because somehow I have a feeling this dates us, you know. But I worked in Toronto, and the big thing in Toronto was, you know, that's where all the action was, the financial center of the universe. And yes, you come to Vancouver, it's green, but there's a reason. It always rains. And I remember when I got back to Vancouver and people called me from Toronto, what's it like there? Michael, it could rain cats and dogs. I lied. I said, it's wonderful. It's sunny. It's you know, we had to beat Vancouver's drum. Well, look, you have done so many developments. I mean, it boggles the mind, you know, the Bay Shore in Cole Harbour, Deering Island and Southlands University at Simon Fraser University, where you're still an adjunct professor, by the way. You know, I mean, is there anything that you haven't done? But which one of all these projects is sort of your baby, your hobby horse?
Ironically, one of the ones I'm quite proud of, which you didn't mention, is Steveston. In 1981, when I left CMHC and I joined NAROD Developments, and they had a partnership agreement with BC Packers, the fish company, Gold Seal Salmon, to where they had 92 acres of land along the waterfront of Steveston. The fishing industry was changing, and the plan was to develop a whole new community on BC Packers' lands. Unfortunately, as you mentioned, Oz, 1983, NARAD went into receivership, like so many other companies. But I was able to set up my own company and continue to work with BC Packers and eventually get approval for that whole new waterfront community. I didn't do all of it. Then a portion of it was done after I left. But one of my great memories from that is the merchants were, local merchants were concerned. They thought this was going to have a negative impact on their community. And I remember, because I just come from CMHC and looked at development differently than many others, I chartered a bus one Saturday morning and took all the merchants down to Laconer to show them another former fishing village that had rebuilt itself, repositioned itself as more of a tourist and new type of place. And by the time that bus made it back to Vancouver that evening, I had, I think, convinced most of the merchants that, in fact, bringing thousands of more people into Steveston would be a positive thing. And anybody who goes down to Steveston, whether it's on the weekend or during the week, knows it really is, perhaps in some respects, the nicest part of Richmond and one of the nicest places in Lower Mainland. And I was quite proud a couple of years ago when CBC had a competition to pick the best community in the Lower Mainland, and Steveston won, and brought back memories.
We love to go there for the fish and chips. As you know, in my earlier, long time ago life, I used to own a fish and chips restaurant, and so I'm always, I have to test the wares, I have to test the fish and chips. And in Steveston, it's one of those places where the fish comes off the boat and you really get the real thing, the real fish and chips.
Two other projects, though, that I should mention. One is Bayshore. I started Bayshore when it was just a parking lot in 1989. Coal Harbor had not yet started its redevelopment. And, I see, you got it. Well, there you are. There's a picture of Bayshore there. But the point is, at the time, you know, Bob Rennie, who I greatly admire, and others questioned whether my wisdom of suggesting the average unit size should be 1,200 square feet at a time when the average unit size was 700 square feet, 600 for one bedroom, 800 for two bedroom. But I wanted it to be, and I thought it could be, one of the nicest communities in all of the Lower Mainland, indeed all of Canada. And I like to think we succeeded. And the other one is Universe City. It's not illustrated here, but that is a new community on Burnaby Mountain on 200 acres of land owned by the university. And I encourage people who are viewing and listening to us, one day go up to Universe City, because it is quite an innovative sort of development. We incorporate a lot of sustainability principles. A couple of the other ones there, though, that some of the golfers will say, my God, don't tell me Geller designed the Furry Creek Golf Course. I hate that place. No, I didn't design the golf course, but I did oversee the planning and approval for the community over 30 years ago, and have been working on it for 5 years ever since. So Elm Park Place, some of the people who live in the west side of Vancouver will recognize that one in the bottom corner in Kerrisdale. I marketed it because I marketed it as apartments for people who didn't want to live in an apartment. Because all my friends would often say, you know what, we're not ready to move into an apartment. And that's because apartments often weren't designed like houses. So I tried to design apartments that felt like being in a house.
Well, if you develop 1,200 square foot units, then you must be sort of shaking your head. Today's the average square footage in Toronto for new condos is around 600 square feet. And I just saw the illustrious Grant Murray from Concord at an event last Friday, and he was telling me that they redesigned one of their buildings and went from larger suites to really low density. And I guess part of it is price, but there's no 1,200 square foot units anywhere being built.
At Bayshore, We were allowed to build 980 units. We didn't even build the full complement because as the development proceeded, people wanted larger suites. And quite a few people, myself included, took two 1400 suites, square foot suites, and put them together. And I actually lived in,
actually
it was too much. You only need 2400 square feet.
I live in a 3600 square foot condo on two floors, and yes, it's too much. But then, the, what is it? The heart wants what the heart wants. Well, look, you're telling me all the things that you did do, and it's just literally incredible. I had the privilege of being on the stage with you a couple of times, I believe, at the Surrey Board of Trade, and I was always amazed. I would sort of talk about pretty pictures, and then somebody would come out of left field on. Want to know something specific about the laws in Surrey or what you could do or not. And you were always the one that could answer almost every single question that was put to you. So listen, are you still a developer or are you now a consultant mainly? What is it that you do right now?
About 10 projects on the go. Nine of them are as a consultant, just advising people. Oftentimes people who may not have a lot of experience in the development world, but have an opportunity. But I do have one remaining development, which believe it or not is it's a partnership with Sharon Seti of Tien Cher, who you know, a very decent and very, very talented guy. And together we own a mobile home park in Nanaimo, perhaps the smallest mobile home park in Nanaimo, which we're repositioning as a manufactured home community. And most people don't realize it, but mobile home parks are not the trailer parks of yesteryear. And some of these manufactured home parks that you see in the Okanagan, on Vancouver Island, and certainly across the states are wonderful communities. And in fact, the word community is apt because people really tend to know one another along the street and so forth. And so we've got approval for that to become a 39 home manufactured home community. And my problem is I'm getting old, and Charon's problem is he's got too many projects. So we actually are looking at the moment at seeing if we can't sell it with all the approvals in place. And if not, then we'll continue with it.
Well, it's interesting. In the city of Quesnel, I used to own a 49 lot subdivision, which was also originally built as trailer park type, although I had to wash out my mouth with soap. We never were allowed to say the word trailer park. It's a right. Mobile home construction. And this was on the river. And I remember one of the rules was we had to put skirting on the all around the mobile home park so that it would look more like a house. We also had another subdivision that we bought, and my partners and I also in Quesnel. And that was a 29-lot subdivision with huge potential. And we subdivided, we developed it ready, and then we sold it to individual owners. So it's all of this is really worthwhile while you're doing it. And sometimes the stuff that goes on with the city and with hydro and with underground this, and we had our own water thing, and we put dye through the sewers to see whether it was, you know, it was always something going on. So what you need is a man like yourself that has seen it all before, that can look at the things and, hey, look, this is a potential problem. Or this is what you should look at. Or let's review that. Let's get some assist, you know, because a lot of developers, I would say right now in Vancouver and Toronto in particular, some of them were novice developers. And there were some problems. As you know, I own a little real estate company, which, by the way, for Sharon, City, we were lucky and fortunate enough to, for the last 5 years, except last year, because I told last year I didn't want anybody to buy anything. So for the last 5 years, so we sold between 30 and 80 units in every one of his buildings in Surrey, because he built quality stuff at an affordable price and close to transport and all these things. Well, look, the world is continuing. I know that you're pro-development and pro-densification, but I understand that tonight there's sort of a meeting in Vancouver about high rises on Broadway, and understand you're not really keen on that.
I am keen on higher density development, and I've certainly been supportive of gentle density, putting four homes in one lot and so forth. I've also been in favor of building apartments along arterial streets. And I did one on 41st. It took years to get approved, but then after it was finished, everybody said we should all be doing that. Similarly on Oak Street. But the Broadway plan was approved 2 years ago, and it promotes higher density development, especially close to the transit stations. And nobody should disagree with that. Makes a lot of sense. But the concern I have is that the corridor expands about five or six streets north and south of Broadway. I mean, it extends down to 1st and U. It extends up to 14th and 15th. And a lot of these are lovely streets, often lined with duplexes and small apartments. But according to the plan, you can come in now and put in high rises at literally 10 times the existing floor space ratio, which I think all of your listeners understand and viewers know, the ratio of the building to the lot, and about seven times the height. And in a way, I'm in favor of doing this, but I think it should be done more incrementally. And so what I've said to the city, look, the transit-oriented area policies would say you could go up to eight stories on this site, not 17 or 18. Why not approve that? Or at three floor space instead of six floor space, approve that. But let's not do it so dramatically, because if we make a lot of mistakes, and I think the city is making a mistake if they approve all these towers, and I think there's 23 of them at the moment as proposals, new councils will come in and the pendulum will swing all the way back to the NIMBYs taking control rather than the YIMBYs. And I guess I'm somewhere in between the two. I am in favor of development, but I think we have to be thoughtful about it.
Well, right now with the BC government coming in with Bill 44, for those listeners and viewers that are not familiar, essentially it does allow, in fact, force the municipality to let on any residential lot to put in a fourplex or as much as a sixplex. And the closer you are to transport development to TODs, the more you can build on it. So that's not every municipality has adopted it. I think it's only Burnaby and Vancouver who actually have the guidelines to proceed. But the point is, does all this talk about what the province does and what the city does it make Vancouver a better place or a worse place?
I think Vancouver, up to say 5 or 10 years ago, I would say Vancouver was a better place, a more beautiful place than it was when I first arrived here in 1974. I look at Granville Island, I look at North Vancouver, I look at the shipyards, I look at Lower Lonsdale, I even look at portions of Burnaby, although there's parts of Burnaby that literally overwhelm me. A lot of the high rise in Richmond, I think, provides housing choices that weren't there before. When I arrived, there were three towers in Richmond. That was it. So in many respects, I would say we were heading in the right direction. But I am a bit concerned in recent years. I think we're starting to perhaps worry, you know, try to genuinely solve what we consider the housing crisis. And it is a housing crisis by just building more. Nothing wrong with building more, but you don't always have to build at such extraordinary floor space ratios, because the first building may be fine, but eventually we start to get more and more like the parts of Toronto that I was happy to leave and parts of New York City that I like to visit but wouldn't want to live there. I stayed at an Airbnb in a condo in downtown Toronto by Concord Pacific's development. I mean, you have to keep the blinds closed all the time because, excuse me, the buildings are so close. At least in Vancouver, we've tried to separate the buildings a little bit more. But the other thing, Oz, and again, people will be surprised, when I was doing the Bayshore development, the city insisted that we create new parks. They said, you're short of park space. because we have a requirement of 2.75 acres of park space for each new 1,000 people who move into the city. And I said, we're next to Stanley Park. They said, it doesn't matter. We actually ended up creating two new parks at Bayshore and giving the city $5 million because of a shortfall in parks. Well, that was 1993. Since then, that standard seems to be lost. And again, when I go back to the Broadway plan, we're going to bring in 20, 30,000 people, but there really is no increase in the park space. And I think it needs to be planned properly. And what does that mean? Well, it means buying up some of those lots and turning them into parks. It may even mean closing off some of the little side streets, creating pocket parks there and so forth, because otherwise we will lose the character and quality of life that made Vancouver the envy of the world from a planning perspective.
And certainly we have examples. Toronto right now is basket case on the pre-sales that are coming to the market and those that are still coming, because the units are very, very small. And some of the largest projects that in Canada's world, like called one of the towers is called The One, which is now $1.5 billion in well, the owner was kicked out, and it's not working. And when you look at all the towers there, and people are smaller and smaller units, and as you said, peeking into each other's bedrooms, not by want, but by the design of the building. You've got to be very, very careful there. I know that you wanted to do something about that physically, and you ran for council. And how did that work out?
My daughters would tell you I was the first loser. No, I came back. I left SFU in 2006 and took 2007 as a sabbatical and went around the world. And what a wonderful experience. You've traveled a lot. I went to about 55 countries on all the continents, and it was quite a great experience. And I came back, and Milton Wong, a name some of your viewers and listeners will remember, a wonderful, wonderful man, was concerned about the downtown East Side and decided to put together a group of people who might be able to help repair those neighborhoods. Milton's family, of course, had grown up in Chinatown. And Ray Spaxman, Larry Beasley, Joe Way, Milton, a number of other people. We interacted with Gene Swanson and others to see if together we could do something to improve that neighborhood. And it was tough. And one of the things I wanted to do was see a broader socio-income mix. And I used the word, and I knew it would upset people. I wanted to normalize that neighborhood. So it wasn't just low-income people and a ghetto. And as a Jew, I'm very conscious of the word ghetto. But that's what the downtown is. It was bad in 2008, and it's worse today. Anyway, that's why I decided to run for council. Peter Ladner was running as mayor. I'd like to think that we would have been a good team. But anyway, I continue to take an interest in what's going on. But people, there's actually a by-election coming up. You want to run for city council, Oz? You know, you need a change of pace, a change in life. My problem is I'm too comfortable doing the things I am. I don't think I could sit through those meetings. And my wife says I would probably yelling, screaming expletives to the people, and that would be the end of my political career.
Maybe that's what it needs. You need to cut through all the... No, but it's true, you know, sometimes, and I'm also very, very easy to get on the anti-government side. Why do they do that? And I firmly believe they don't sit around the table looking at how they could screw the public. No, they're doing the best they can. Only the best they can is not good enough. I mean, they are either following an ideology that perhaps the outcome has unintended consequences, or like you point out, I mean, the very best intention people are usually not the ones that are being elected. But look, that brings me to the famous Bill 44 in BC and Bill 47, and perhaps even Bill 14, which sort of was snuck in there and essentially allows the city not to issue a building permit. And only on the day before the building permit is issued will the developer know what the offsite costs are, which is sort of a ridiculous kind of a thing. So what do you think about all the BC government being forcefully ramming things down the municipalities?
I agree entirely with the direction, but I think the pendulum has swung far too far. For instance, I actually did do two projects in West Vancouver where I put four homes on one lot. They were larger lots, about 12,000 square feet. It was a bit of an effort. I got the approval because I kept heritage houses. But what it did was it proved that you can put four homes or so forth on one lot. Bill 44, as you pointed out earlier, is allowing you to build four homes on one lot or six homes if you're closer to public transit, a rapid transit, a bus line. But the problem I have with it is it's permitted on every single family lot throughout the entire province in communities with 5,000 residents or more. Well, it's nuts. It's really nuts, because a lot of those places, it doesn't make sense in terms of available infrastructure. There isn't necessarily even a need for it. And what you start to do is get spotty development. So what I have suggested to people is keep the concept, but let's begin to focus where we allow this to happen. Maybe it should happen behind the arterials. Maybe it should happen around parks. Maybe it should happen near schools. But don't say it must happen or must be permitted on every lot in the province. It doesn't make sense. The other one you mentioned, Oz 47, is the one about transit-oriented area. And again, the idea of building more homes close to public transit is perfect. Makes absolute sense. But the way they're doing is drawing circles around the station. And, if you're just on one side of the circle, you're a two-story. And if you're on the other side of the circle, you're eight-story. That's not quite the way to plan. And I was thinking in the shower this morning, when I studied planning, we often discuss, if you're going to change density or building form, do you do it on both sides of a street, or do you do it on one side of the street, not the other side, or do you do it on the lanes? And I think that's the kind of conversation we should have to make sure we continue to plan. I love going to Europe, because I think, generally speaking, European cities are planned much better than North American cities. And as I hinted at earlier, I am worried that Vancouver is now heading in the wrong direction after having been going in the right direction for 50 years.
Well, certainly in Europe also, you have a much higher, larger population, so you have to get much better planning. I remember, though, that my city of Cologne in Germany, if you turn right on any corner and then turn right again, you're probably in another city, right? Because nothing is like Vancouver. You turn right and you turn right again, you're back to where you were. It's sort of the planning extraordinary, which was done, 100 years ago to get us to, but then we had the luxury of extra space and a smaller population. So things have to be done. Not all development is good, but I know in my city of Cologne, the downtown area of Cologne is no cars, but it has been that way, Michael, for 50 years. It's not some new concept. The major streets, major shopping streets in downtown Cologne is no cars, right? And so I got one of my old friends wrote me that she bought a condo, and in that building, no parking is provided. In fact, you have to sign that, that you will use the, you will not have cars there. Wow. So they have different problems because of the huge increases in population. But look, now
Hold it. Let's talk about that a little bit more, because that's a very important aspect of these two new bills. For years, I've always advocated for lower parking requirements. I mean, when I came here, you often had to have two parking spaces for every single family house off street. Every townhouse, 1.5 parking spaces for every apartment. And I thought that was excessive. And what I used to suggest in every talk I gave is, let's take the city minimum parking requirements and turn them into the maximum requirements. But ironically, now what's happening is the city are being told you can't require any parking by the province. Now, again, realistically, I put in one parking space for each of my units in West Vancouver and a couple of off-street parking spaces for visitors. And the number one complaint was there's not enough parking. Now, I got away with it because I'm the only development with four homes on one lot. But if it's the whole street with four homes on one lot, then people are going to be fighting for parking spaces. Now, I wrote that in an article in the Vancouver Sun, and my editor did say, Michael, we prefer not to use the word fighting because there's too much fighting going on already. Well, I said, fine, I'll say, we'll find another word. But that is a consideration. Now, the interesting thing is, to be fair, there is a whole new generation, unlike you and me, who own three cars each. They don't own a car. That some of them don't even have a driver's license, but many of them do use car share. And I've been working in Russia. I'm not working recently, but I was there for 8 years. And I would give talks about promotion of the notion of car share. And I always remember one student in Kazan coming up to me after one of my talks. Ozzy, he said, Mr. Geller, I just want you to know our country has a long history of sharing. We don't want to start having to share cars. But people here do share cars, and it makes a lot of sense. But it's going to take a while, I think, to get to the level of car ownership where not requiring any parking is going to work.
My oldest grandson sat me down and says, look, Opa, I'm renting car shares all the time. I use the Evo, and they even have now some with four doors. And he said, if I go shopping, maybe 4 weeks shopping, I'll take the bigger car and I have a full day. And otherwise, I just use it when I can. Now he says, do you know that alone the insurance that you pay pays for all of my ride sharing for the whole year? You know, and gas and insurance and all of those things. Okay. I said, don't beat me up with logic. I still want to. And I know you probably, I have no idea how you feel about EVs, but in my Ozbuzz newsletter, I've been writing about against EVs. Even though I like Elon Musk, I did not like what we're doing. I consider an electric vehicle the pioneers.
One more quick sentence. In 2010, I went to Expo 2010 in Shanghai. And I try to go to every international expo because it gives you an opportunity to see the future. And I saw so many electric cars, I came back absolutely convinced that that was the future and it was for me. But I was concerned, like I'd seen how Fisker had gone out of business and a couple of the others. I did try to buy one for the university community. But when I was in California in 2013 and saw the Tesla, I thought, this is for me. I was in Newport, California, and I ordered a Tesla, and I had one of the first ones in Vancouver, and I've driven a Tesla ever since. I'm on my second. But the only reason I want to mention this is I've been involved with the Urban Development Institute, which is the developers organization and lobby group, whatever you want to say about it. But it's a good group. And they often would comment on municipal policies. And I remember when Vancouver wanted to require 20% of all parking spaces to be fitted up with electric charging. And my friends at UDI said, no, we shouldn't, don't allow this. And I was the odd man out. Well, I just read this morning that now District of North Vancouver says every parking space has to have an electric charging outlet. And I think it makes sense. I mean, bigger problem, which I'm sure you're appreciating, is do we have enough electric capacity for all of these EVs, and we don't, and so forth. But no, I think anybody who's ever driven one, in fact, you should drive one. You know, you'd probably say, "Oh my God, this is fantastic."
I have. There was a there used to be a little group of people that took 9 cars. And you drove them from West Vancouver to Squamish, and you got to drive all 8 cars. And one of them was a Tesla, and one of them was a Ferrari. Well, there's no question in my mind which I prefer to drive. But let's not get into EV because it's a lot of passion about this. I think we are nowhere near ready. We will need 10 site C dams output, and it took us 6 years to plan it, and or 10 years to plan it, and 6 years to build it against all sorts of opposition just to pull them on. So to get the electricity ready is still a thing, in particular when you're driving long distances. I mean, it's one thing if I'm just in town, it's cheaper. My son-in-law has a, but he also works for the university, he's a math professor. And so, you know, he and I, we can debate this forever. The point is, that's what makes the world go around. Of course, there will be progress, but there will be pioneers. And I can name you dozens of them that maybe didn't buy the right kind of a Tesla or whatever, but doesn't start in the summer with air conditioning on it, doesn't start in the winter because it's too cold. There are lineups to just get, you know. In fact, I was at a party last Friday night, and the fellow that was there came back from California. And he says, when it used to be getting gas, I would just drive into a gas station, and even if I had to wait 20 minutes, that was it. But now, he says, I can wait there for 2 hours if they go on and get a full charge. So there are these things that need to be fixed, and eventually it'll all go. Now, let me ask you this, Michael. There are a lot of people in the development industry. Which ones do you admire?
That's interesting. Well, I've always admired Michael O'Dane. Now, some people may know that name because of the O'Dane Galleries, the one at Whistler here. But Michael, I think, is a hero of mine because he's had a very varied background. And his company, Polygon Homes, is an excellent home builder. And I think that over the years, although they've tended to be fairly conservative in what terms of what they've built, those polygon homes and polygon communities are very good. I mean, over the years, I've watched builders like Nat Boza and Norm Cressy. Again, two people who have consistently been building and building good projects. And I think generally speaking, have introduced ideas that eventually gain currency. Nat Boza was always a huge fan of concrete. And people used to make fun of him for building concrete when he could be building wood. Well, I think today we realize it made a lot of sense to build concrete. But there are quite a few. We mentioned Charon Setty. I worked with him now for 10 years. I still don't know how to pronounce his name properly, but he, I think, is a creative guy. He's about to do a big development in Penticton with his son. But, you know, he started small. He got bigger and bigger, and he was always cautious. But I think he's a good builder. And you mentioned you've sold some of his homes as well. But I like the people who are willing to take chances, to do more innovative things. And those are the people I often emulate. Or try to emulate, although I've never been big. I don't want to be big, but I like to do things that are a little bit different.
Well, like people like Sharon City is a great community builder, and he takes an area like Wally, where you literally, well, that used to say Wally, and it said immediately visions of drug use and bad things. He took it, changed it completely, and I personally have bought probably a dozen condos from him over since 2016. Me and my partner are in part of every one of the developments. It's just that I felt in 2022, my headline in my newsletter was "The High is in Place," and by that I actually had picked Surrey, and I felt that an average price of $1,980,000 for just any old shack in Surrey, that's it. I mean, what would be a regular house be worth? $3 million in Surrey, you know, and I drank my own milk. I decided in our real estate company we were not going to market any kind of pre-sale. I just felt the government was anti-development, the government was anti-investor, and all of the things that were going on. But look, I got to ask you something personal. It's always people build housing, people develop housing, people have. But where do people like you, who are so involved, so literally such a legend in the industry, and not just, as you pointed out, about Russia making speeches in China and everywhere, where do you live?
I actually live in one of my developments. I live on an island within the boundary of the city of Vancouver. And the story is, I mentioned to you, I worked on the rezoning of the waterfront of Steveston. And after we got the rezoning, the president of BC Packers, the late Bruce Buchanan, took me to dinner. And over dessert, he put a photograph on the table. And I said, watch this. He said, your next project. And it's 1985. And it was a photograph of 25 acres of land in Vancouver, in an area known as Southlands, south of Southwest Marine Drive. It's where BC Packers had a net loft and a boat repair facility known as the Celtic Shipyard. And I was engaged to help put in place a plan for the redevelopment of this property. A quick story. We went in to see Ray Spaxman to tell him we wanted to develop the land. He said, what do you want to do with it? I said, we want to put housing on the island. It's zoned RS1. Come on, Geller, he said. You know that's just an accident of zoning. There's a line all along the shoreline. This island fell outside. It's been industrial use for 100 years. After we left, Bruce Buchanan said, Geller, if it is an accident of zoning, and he's right, the line was drawn accidentally, does that mean the zoning is not valid? I said, I think it is, but let me get you a legal opinion. We went to Jonathan Baker. I hope he listens to this one day, a brilliant real estate lawyer. He wrote me an opinion. It said, zoning is like pregnancy. It's a blessed event, whether accidental or not. Based on that, we proceeded. We put 37 homes and a public park on the island. I built a home in 1992, never knowing if I would really stay here. But on and off, I've been here ever since.
Well, you must like it. I mean, that's a long time. You're not really that old. Come on. Now, look, one of the things that sets you, makes you different than anybody else, apart from 100 things that do make you look different, you do something at Christmas time where you have an annual Christmas card that are quite interesting. So why don't you tell the listeners and viewers what you have planned for 2024?
Yeah, well, very quickly. I started this when I set up my company in 1983. And I always thought Christmas is a good time to stay in touch with people. And so often in our lives, we meet lots of people, people that we meet, we enjoy, but we just don't have time to get together with them. So Christmas is an opportunity. But for me, it was also a marketing opportunity to market my company. And I would do different things. And I remember one year after the Langara Gardens rezoning proposal that was turned down, I was in the dentist chair hearing the song, Santa Claus is Coming to Town. And all I could think of is, well, he better not come to my neighborhood because they won't let him stay here. And my daughters helped me with that one. Rudolph, Eat Yellow Snow. But over the years, since 2011, I've been trying to think of different ideas for the 12 days of Christmas, 12 affordable housing ideas and 12 innovative planning ideas from around the world and so forth. This year, I'm actually, give advance notice, I'm doing a Christmas card based on the concept of sharing. We joked before about car sharing. You know, so many people are struggling with housing affordability and life affordability. Bike sharing, car sharing, house sharing, I think are ideas that need to be further promoted. And I once lived in an apartment in Ottawa with another fellow. We shared a one bedroom, but we could because there was a door to the living room. So that living room became my bedroom at night. Virtually every one bedroom apartment designed and built in Vancouver today has one big living, dining, kitchen space. You can't really use it as a sleeping area at night, but go to Europe, go to Russia. People don't let half the apartment sit empty half the time. So I'm promoting this in a new development that I'm working on as a consultant in North Vancouver, and I'm going to try and promote this idea. When I was at SFU, we came up with the idea. The students were upset, and I think we're running out of time, but the students were upset because I wasn't building housing for students. And I said, we are. Where do you live now? They said, we live in basement suites. I said, well, we're just building apartments, no housing. But I said, maybe we could create the equivalent of a basement suite in an apartment. Like, why couldn't the third bedroom have its own door to the corridor and be like a little rental suite until such time as the family might want to use that bedroom? We called them lock-off suites, mortgage helpers in the sky, and got approval thanks to City of Burnaby. There's another concept that is slowly gaining currency, but there are a lot of ideas, Oz, that could make, I think, housing more affordable and living generally more socially acceptable.
And you're going to do all that in the 12 days leading up to Christmas and sharing some of those difficult and I'm sure wonderful ideas to all of us to make a better life. And the word sharing, it can be applied not just to housing, but to everything in life. Thank you so much for taking the time. I keep saying you're a legend, but you know, you tell everybody is a legend. You know, we say this to be nice, but you, sir, are a legend. And I thank you for taking the time to join me. Take care.
Thanks for your kind words. Bye-bye.